At first, the tribes of men had lived upon the earth apart and free of evils and of tiresome toil and hard diseases, which have brought to men their dooms, because by hardship mortal men are quickly aged. But with her hands the woman raised the jar's great lid, released all these, devising grievous cares for men. That's a passage from Hesiod describing Pandora's release of evil into the world. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
He's the other guy, the competitor of Homer, the other ancient Greek poet who wrote about gods and mortals. Why do we know less about the works of Hesiod than about Homer's Odyssey and Iliad? By becoming the first poet to put his own life into a poem, how did Hesiod change poetry? What does he have to say about the creation of the world, farming, women, and other topics? Joining us to explore Hesiod is Will Brockless, professor of classics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Well, Hesiod, competitor of Homer, how accurate would that be? Did they even live in the same time period, in the same place? Do we know?
These are big questions that are ongoing topics of investigation. Most people would say that the poems, similar to how we have them, were produced at a similar sort of time, roughly sort of 700 BCE. Which, if we were to imagine that Homer and Hesiod were real guys, then that would place them pretty much as contemporaries. There was a tradition in the ancient world that they had a competition with one another, a competition in which Homer seems to have wiped the floor with Hesiod, but at the end, the presiding judge, who didn't listen to any of the spectators, awarded the prize to Hesiod because he was talking about good edifying things, and that's what we wanted from a poet. So, yeah, there has been this long tradition of imagining a contact between them. But on the other side of things, a lot of scholars see them as equally shadowy figures. Homer, very, very shadowy figure that, if he existed, never mentions himself as Homer in his poems and almost never uses the first person. Hesiod is a presence in his poems. But at the same time, there's a big debate as to whether this was a real guy or whether it's just people taking on a pose in order to recite this sort of verse.
Taking on what kind of a pose? What kind of a personality? Is it consistent among all these poems attributed to Hesiod?
Right. Well, Hesiod, he's kind of a grumpy guy. He complains quite a lot about his life in this particular part of Greece. They live in a very, very tough town that's very difficult to farm in, and that's what he wants to do for a living.
Complains about the weather.
Yeah, and he complains about the weather, complains about women. I'm afraid he is a bit of a misogynist, which of course is a reason why these days we're not quite so attracted to the guy. And he also complains about his brother. He's got this brother called Perses.
He sounds like a stand-up comic to me. Maybe that's the founding of this tradition.
Yeah. There is a certain amount of humour about what he does. Sometimes it seems to go so far that in the end it can be a bit quite amusing. And there is actually a bit of crossover with, I think, at least the tone of iambic poetry. That was a different sort of ancient Greek poetry where there were stock characters and characters who would be lampooned, who would complain about one another. And it seems a similar kind of situation with Hesiod and his brother Perses, who possibly were stock characters. The Perses perhaps means the plunderer, this guy who takes Hesiod and Perses' common inheritance and manages to steal it in some way through crooked judgments or that sort of thing.
Well, what does Hesiod say about himself, other than that he doesn't like the weather where he came from?
Right. Well, the very first thing we hear about Hesiod, if I might read a little passage, is from very near the start of the Theogony, which is all about the generations of the gods. And he depicts himself meeting the Muses on Mount Helicon. And this is what he says in Martin West's translation. And once the Muses taught Hesiod fine singing as he tended his lambs below holy Helicon. This is what the goddesses said to me first, the Olympian Muses, daughters of Zeus the Aegis-bearer. Shepherds that camp in the wild, disgraces merest bellies. We know how to tell many lies that sound like truth, but we know to sing reality when we will. So said mighty Zeus's daughters, the sure of utterance, and they gave me a branch of springing bay to pluck for a staff, a handsome one, and they breathed into me wondrous voice, so that I should celebrate things of the future and things that were aforetime. And they told me to sing of the family of the blessed ones who are for ever, and first and last always to sing of themselves. There we have what appears to be a bit of biographical detail, but of course you wouldn't know quite whether to trust somebody who comes up to you and says, hey, I'm Hesiod, and the other day I met these goddesses on the mountain and they imparted to me the gift of song and that sort of thing. So that's a bit troubling, that the very first bit of biography we have about him seems a little untrustworthy, but he does seem a very real character. And again, you've got this very sort of vivid interaction between two characters, the Muses having a go at Hesiod for being a mere belly, him and his fellow shepherds, that I guess he's supposedly just living hand to mouth and doesn't appreciate culture and all that sort of thing, and they're introducing him to that. But yeah, so this sort of contrast between a seemingly very real figure and this rather sort of outlandish meeting that's described here.
What about the class that Hesiod, you know, presents himself as coming from or talking about or for?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting question. When we compare Hesiod to the concerns of Homeric poetry, well, in Homeric poetry, it's very much about the nobles and the warriors who had all the fancy armour and did all the impressive fighting. They had all the fancy armour and that sort of thing. And it's also about nobles depicted in their great halls and all that sort of thing. Whereas Hesiod is much more about the common man, particularly in his poem The Works and Days. You've basically got two major poems, the Theogony about the gods and The Works and Days about humankind. And The Works and Days focuses on poor people, supposedly like Hesiod himself and like Perses, who should be farming to earn a living and should be working hard from the sweat of their brow. So there is a bit of a class distinction between the two sets of poems. However, it is the case that Hesiod sees some sort of connection between himself and kings. In the Theogony, he's given this sceptre, as we just heard, and that's something that kings carry around. And also, a little later on in the Theogony, he says that kings have the gift of speech from the Muses, much as he has the gift of speech from the Muses. In The Works and Days, it's a bit different. He is having a go at kings who are giving crooked judgments, such as the crooked judgment that seems to have done him out of his inheritance. So, yeah, it's not entirely clear-cut where he stands with regards to the kings, the nobles. But what is clear is that he doesn't belong to that class. He might have connections through his common gift of speech, but he's very definitely a poor guy.
So if we were going to contrast him with Homer again, it would be almost like he would be the working man, the working class poet.
Yeah, pretty much. And that, of course, gives his poetry great interest for us because particularly recently, people have wanted to see a more holistic view of Greek society rather than just concentrating on the rich people and the powerful people. You want to see what everybody's doing. And so Hesiod's great for giving you some sense of that.
So if we start with a Theogony, the origin of the gods, is Hesiod just sort of reciting what he would have learned almost like a catechism in terms of the names of the different gods and what they do? Where is he getting his material?
That is quite a difficult question because this is pretty much the first Greek text that is presenting this material. We do have some hints of that in that there are some similarities with Near Eastern material. For instance, there's some Hittite poetry. The Hittites live in Western Turkey, 400, a bit further ago than Hesiod is supposed to have been around. So there seems to be some connection with that, and there's maybe an inheritance from that tradition of a succession among the gods. One of the things that comes across in Hesiod is that each king of the gods displaces the last king of the gods through an act of violence, which seems to be something that was told about in the Near East. So that may well have come across into Greek culture and is reflected in Hesiod. We shouldn't, though, see Hesiod as just reciting the orthodoxy, because a big part of archaic Greek poetry seems to have been competition between different poets as to who could get the right version. And when we hear, well, we just heard the Muses, when they say to Hesiod, "We know to tell many lies that sound like truth, but we know to sing reality when we will," some people take that as a stab at his fellow poets, as in the Muses are going to tell Hesiod how to sing reality, he's going to be able to sing how things really are, whereas the other poets just say things that kind of sound like the truth but aren't actually the truth.
But is it, I guess one of the things, you know, we label it mythology when you're talking about Zeus and some of the other characters, but for Hesiod it would have been religion?
Yeah, religion's a bit of a difficult term in the Greek world because, I mean, as we were just saying, it seems to imply a pretty concrete set of doctrines, and it's often in our thinking connected with something written down. And at this point, things appear to have been much more fluid, and it was about sort of oral storytelling and, as I say, about sort of competition between different versions. And that was part of Greek religious expression. But it, religion itself, so something sort of more solid, more stabilised, was a bit less of an important concept.
In Hesiod's Theogony, do we get a sense of gods mixing with men, or is this just a description of relations among the gods?
Well, yeah, that's one thing that, if we're going to distinguish Hesiod's poetry and Homer, that seems pretty distinct, that for the most part the gods and the men are keeping separate from one another. There is the myth of Pandora, which, Emily, you introduced our discussion with, which does seem to be about the first woman. And this is that the first woman is created by the gods and sent to men. That story comes just after the myth of Prometheus. And in fact, I think it might be an idea just to read through the Hesiodic version of Prometheus. This is from the Theogony. And this seems to be a very important passage about the relationship between gods and mortals from the Theogony. "For when gods and mortal men were coming to a settlement at Mekone, he had carved up a big ox," that's Prometheus, "had carved up a big ox and served it in such a way as to mislead Zeus. For him he laid out meat and entrails rich with fat in the hide, covering it in the ox's stomach, while for men he laid out the ox's white bones, which he arranged carefully for a cunning trick by covering them in glistening fat. Then the father of gods and men said to him, 'Son of Iapetus, outstanding among all the lords, my good sir, how unfairly you have divided the portions.' So chided Zeus, whose designs do not fail, but crooked schemer Prometheus, smiling quietly and intent on deceit, said to him, 'Zeus, greatest and most glorious of the eternal fathers, choose then whichever of them the spirit in your breast bids you.' He spoke meaning trickery, but Zeus, whose designs do not fail, recognised the trick and did not mistake it, and he boded evil in his heart for mortal men, which was to come to pass. With both hands he took up the white fat, and he grew angrier about the lungs, and wrath reached him to the spirit, when he saw the white ox bones set for a cunning trick. Ever since that, the peoples on earth have burned white bones for the immortals on aromatic altars." And when scholars have come to that story, as I say, they've seen it as something very important for the relationship between gods and men. And it seems to be the case that before this point, the gods and men would perhaps even dine together and they would dine on the same things. Whereas in this sacrifice, because of Prometheus' trickery, from that point on, they dine on different things. That basically the mortals get meat and the immortals get the sort of fat and bones.
So what are we meant to think of that?
Well, it doesn't seem a very good deal for the immortals, but it may in fact tell us something about the nature of the two sets of beings. That on the one side you've got the immortals who get the smoke from the fat and the bones, which is kind of in keeping with their, maybe a little insubstantial because you can't see them, but at the same time also eternal essence, because smoke, you don't imagine maybe as something corruptible. Whereas, of course, meat is something that if you leave out in the sun is not going to last very long, much as mortals.
There's some consolation
don't last very long, yeah. So each gets the portion that's kind of suitable to that particular being. Yeah, on the one level, that's what the story is telling us, and it's a memory of that sort of division of the two sets of beings. On another level, of course, much as elsewhere in Hesiod, it's a story full of characters, that you've got the crooked Prometheus who's trying to deceive Zeus, and you've got Zeus who's sort of taking one step back and sort of raising an eyebrow and seeing through Prometheus's plans. That's one thing that Hesiod does, is he takes these traditional tales and inserts a bit of drama to them and a bit of characterful interest.
What about the aspect of Prometheus that sometimes comes up, where he's like a savior figure that brings fire to mankind and then is punished by Zeus with the eagle eating out his liver?
Yeah, that is also in Hesiod. As a consequence for Prometheus's trickery at this first sacrifice, Zeus decides, because Prometheus seem to have been favouring mortals, to punish mortals by hiding fire. So this is even worse, that they're stuck with perishable meat and they don't have anything to cook it with. So this is a bad situation. And Prometheus, who seems to have some sympathies with mankind, not in Hesiod as the creator of mankind, although he is in some versions, but he's got some sort of sympathy with mankind. And so he steals fire and gives it to mankind, and he gets punished for that, as you say. He's pinioned to a rock, and there's a bird coming and eating out his immortal liver every day, which doesn't sound too great. And also, as a punishment for this theft of fire, Zeus decides to punish mortals yet again. And at least as this is framed in Hesiod, he sends Pandora as a deceptive gift to them, much as Prometheus had produced a deceptive gift for him.
We'll find out more about Pandora when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
For formerly the tribes of men on earth lived remote from ills, without harsh toil and the grievous sicknesses that are deadly to men. But the woman unstopped the jar and let it all out, and brought grim cares upon mankind. Only hope remained there inside in her secure dwelling under the lip of the jar, and did not fly out, because the woman put the lid back in time by the providence of Zeus, the cloud-gatherer who bears the aegis. But for the rest, countless troubles roam among men. Full of ills is the earth and full the sea. Sicknesses visit men by day and others by night, uninvited, bringing ill to mortals silently, because Zeus the resourceful deprived them of voice. Thus there is no way to evade the purpose of Zeus.
That's a passage describing Pandora in Hesiod's Theogony from the 700s B.C. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Will Brockless, and we are looking at that other ancient Greek poet, Hesiod. Well, there we go, blaming women, right?
Yeah, I'm afraid so, in that particular story. Although the blame is kind of split between different agents, because this seems part of the plan of Zeus, actually, to punish mankind because Prometheus had stolen fire on their behalf. So, I mean, Zeus kind of sets this up. I mean, what's going to happen? You send somebody down to Earth with this big jar full of all sorts of bad things, and it's not just going to remain unopened forever, is it? So it gets opened.
Kind of like a big shiny horse that you might send.
Pretty much, yes.
Why do we think of it as Pandora's box? Because both translations that we've used have said jar.
Yeah, the box is something that comes in quite a bit later than Hesiod. I guess that the boxes at this time were not something that was in common use. That a box in the ancient world, well, boxes are particularly associated with perfumes and jewellery and all that sort of thing, so were associated with the things that women in the ancient world were quite often interested in. And so it made sense that that came into the story of the first woman. But at this stage, I'm not sure we've got people using boxes so much. So, yeah, you've got the jar at this stage. There's maybe some symbolism there. For instance, the combination of the earth and the underworld seems, well, with particular focus on the underworld, seems to be conceived of in Hesiod as like a jar. So maybe there's some sense of this jar being like the earth bringing forth the good things. This jar brings forth bad things. And so that may be behind this particular choice.
So what kind of commentary, if any, do we get from the poet, from Hesiod in the Theogony? I mean, we've already set him up as being a misogynist. So is he making any comment with the story of Pandora, or is it just his introduction of this particular character?
A comment on women? Or
yes.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, there does seem to be a sense in Hesiod. I mean, he's addressing a male audience, and he's seeing this, well, he sees the whole world from the perspective of things that can go wrong, really, for mankind. And if he's addressing a male audience, that then he wants to talk about things that male audience might fear from women and that sort of thing. He goes to some lengths elsewhere in the Works and Days, his poem about mankind and man's toils, about how one should go about choosing a wife, one being a part of this male audience should go about choosing a wife. And he doesn't really have too much optimism about that either, I'm afraid. But he sees it as necessary, because otherwise what will happen when you die? All your heirs and relatives will all turn up and divide your property.
Whereas that no-good brother of yours.
Exactly. He has this no-good brother who's run off with his inheritance. So this is a great fear of his, and he needs to be able to pass his inheritance on properly.
What about the hope that was left in that jar that Pandora opened?
Well, yeah, this is a really puzzling aspect of this scene. First of all, that this is supposedly a jar that's full of all sorts of bad things. And then you think, well, hope, that sounds like a great thing to have. So what's that doing in the jar with bad things? Some people have come along and said, oh, well, we're misunderstanding the Greek word, which is elpis, for hope. That maybe this just means blind hope, which doesn't really have any concrete expectations attached to it, and it's sort of deceptive, and you're just being led along despite the fact that the world's really quite bad, and you shouldn't have hope in this way. And there are other interpretations as well. I mean, possibly it's a sort of consolation prize from Zeus that he sends along hope just to make all these terrible things bearable that he sent us. There's also a rather more worrying possibility that maybe hope is something that isn't in the world, because it seems that all of these evil things escape, and just before hope's about to get out of the jar, Pandora puts the lid back on.
That's a pretty dark
finale for it all. It reminds me a little of a Chinese fortune I got that said, hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. You know, it's as if, well, there's some hope in there, but don't expect it to come out.
Yeah, maybe a little bit like that. There's something a little bit disturbing about that scene. But, yeah, the Works and Days in general, this poem about farming and the farmer's year and how much you have to toil, is really quite a sort of pessimistic work. And, well, in a way, it's intended to be like that, because it's supposed to persuade people. He's got this brother who seems to have robbed him of his inheritance. He's trying to convince this brother that he should go out and be a farmer and actually earn an honest wage. And to do that, he kind of has to convince his brother that the world is quite a difficult place, and you have to work hard in order to achieve something. And he wants to tell his audience this as well, that the world is a difficult place and so we have to work hard. And part of these negative attitudes that he gets surrounding the idea of hope, unfortunately surrounding the idea of women in Hesiod, is part of the rhetoric to try and motivate people to get out there and work hard and try and face these difficulties that he's imagining that there are in the world.
But how is it motivating if you have mean gods? I mean, how can we look at Zeus as anything other than mean? If he punishes Prometheus for giving us fire and he sends Pandora to bring evil into the world.
Yeah, there certainly seems to be a bit of negativity coming from the gods there. But the picture we get is of mixed blessings from the gods. I mean, that here possibly Zeus sends hope to kind of make mortal life a bit more bearable. Elsewhere in the Works and Days, he's mentioned as a god who brings rain, which is a great thing for a farmer. For the most part, though, in fact, the gods and men in Hesiod are kind of separate from one another. The gods get on with their bickering in the Theogony. They have their succession myth. And the men, well, they had this past where they were closer to the gods, that they had their golden and silver races, which were really quite blessed and were close to the gods. But in more recent times, this has just been a situation where men have gone their separate way and have to make the best of it for themselves.
So do we have the sense that possibly unlike Homer, that the audience for Hesiod was quite possibly farmers by the time we get into these descriptions of the hard toil of working the land?
Yeah, that's certainly possible. The first real sense we get of a stable audience for both Homer and Hesiod really is really in classical Athens, where there were recitations of both poets, focusing mostly on Homer, but there are also recitations of Hesiod. Before then, though, it's a bit of a puzzle as to whether it would be, in fact, farmers listening to this sort of poetry, or whether the farmers would know all this information already and so wouldn't need it recited to them. And to what extent this was just a kind of folk memory for the people as a whole, that this was important knowledge and so one needed a kind of repository for it. You put it in your poems and the poems have regular meter and so it makes it easier to construct these poems.
Sure.
And to remember them. And so in that way you get a repository of knowledge about the gods in Hesiod's Theogony, and you get a repository of knowledge about human affairs in the Works and Days. And yeah, then it becomes a big question: to what extent are you supposed to be accessing this knowledge like a textbook and sort of looking things up, as it were, or whether this is just something that's important to keep on record?
Do we ever get to a point, or at what point do we have a reciter reciting poetry by somebody else? In other words, Hesiod, did the poems of Hesiod continue after his death with other people reciting them?
Yes, certainly. Again, when we get down to classical times, things are a bit hazy before then in terms of exactly what's going on. I mean, clearly these poems are being performed. We can see the poems of Homer, for instance, reflected in vase paintings from very early on. But in classical times, you've got guys called rhapsodes who are coming along and they are reciting these verses professionally. And by that stage, there's probably less variety in what is being recited. In archaic times, it's possible there were quite a lot of different versions of these poems, of which we have one that maybe kind of approximates one from the archaic times. But by classical times, things were a bit more canonical and there were texts that you could refer to and people would recite from memory rather than composing afresh to a certain extent, like a jazz musician would do, that you have certain standards that everybody knows, but each time you perform that standard, you perform it in a different way.
Right, so, these riffs.
And what do we miss by reading it in translation? When you read it in the ancient Greek, what do you sort of hear in terms of the music of it or the imagery that we can't quite get in English?
Well, one of the things that comes across is actually the music of the lists that we get in the Theogony, that these especially can be really quite off-putting for the modern reader, that it can come across as a bit like sort of reading the phone book. But when you actually hear them in ancient Greek, that they do have a certain poetry to them and certain sounds that they keep coming back.
So what sort of list would this be?
Well, I mean, I could give you one if you'd like. Here we have Well, we've got some of the descendants of Tethys and Oceanus, who are gods of the ocean, understandably. And this is from the Theogony, quite early on. And it says, "And Tethys bore the holy family of nymphs, who nurture men on earth with the Lord Apollo and the rivers, having this function allotted by Zeus. Patho and Admete, Vianthe and Electra, Doris, Primno and godlike Urania, Hippo, Clymene, Rhodoe and Calliroe, Zeuxo, Clytia, Idia and Pasithoe, Clexaura and Galaxaura, lovely Dione, Melibosis, Thoe and fair Polydora, Cisseus of lovely form, Pluto of big dark eyes, Perseus, Yanera, Iacaste and Xanthi, lovely Petraea, Menestho, Europa, Metis, Eurynome, and saffron-robed Telesto, Chryseis, Aisha, and desirable Calypso, Eudora, Tichy, Amphiro, Ocuroe, and Styx, who is chief among them all."
Would that partly have been a kind of way of showing off for the person reciting, the way, you know, a patter song in Gilbert and Sullivan or something, where you're just,
yeah,
kind of, you know, rattling off all kinds of things?
Yeah, that's a great parallel with those kind of listing songs in Gilbert and Sullivan, where that's the other thing we miss if we're just looking at this as a text, that this is very much performance poetry. And when you are performing these great long lists, then that's really quite impressive. That's okay, in later times, these would probably have been committed to memory, and it's impressive to be able to memorize an enormous long list, and there's a lot of them in the Theogony. But at the same time, in archaic times, it was rather different, that this was probably somebody putting together a list on the spot, which is really quite a feat to have all these names in your head and to be able to think, okay, well, that one fits in that place in the meter, and then this one, and then this one, and I can make a bit of sound play by putting those two together. And you're doing all this spontaneously, just in the rhythm of when you're saying them. So it would be really quite challenging and very impressive in performance to be able to go through these lists. So that's maybe what we should be doing with these lists, is very much sort of reading them out to ourselves and sort of hearing how they are and imagining how they would be when you're performing them.
The relationship between then gods and architecture, you've already between gods and agriculture, you've already mentioned that Zeus, in addition to causing certain havoc in human life, does provide the rain in agricultural needs. But is this more really of a practical tome, as you've described it, for the farmer, or is it richly mixed with, again, with the gods?
Yeah, for the most part, the two are kept separate. There is one very important passage very early on in the Works and Days, this agricultural poem, where Hesiod talks about two types of strife, and this is goddesses, two goddesses called Strife. And apparently there's the Strife, who is actually mentioned in the Theogony as being a really negative type of goddess who causes gods and mortals to fall out with one another. This is the sort of Strife who's involved at the marriage of Peleus and Thetis, who sends down the golden apple saying to the fairest, and then the goddesses are bickering with one another and Paris has to decide who's the most beautiful, and then it leads to the Trojan War, etc.
So
that's the bad Strife. But Hesiod, and here he kind of corrects himself, because in the Theogony, as I say, there's just the one Strife that he mentions. He says, well, actually, there are two. When you actually look at things from a mortal perspective, there's also Strife, who causes useful competition between mortals. And as Martin West's translation says, so potter is piqued with potter, joiner with joiner, beggar begrudges beggar, and singer singer. And the idea is that all these different guys in their professions will compete with one another and in that way work harder, because Hesiod is very much into hard work and he likes to see people work.
Trying to imagine competition between beggars, who can grab your lapel the fastest, or how does that work?
Well, it is actually something that's depicted in the Odyssey, where when Odysseus turns up back at his halls and the suitors are enjoying themselves there, they have this beggar called Eros, who likes to hang out with them and get some price cuts of meat from time to time and that sort of thing. And Odysseus turns up disguised as a beggar. So this is a bit of a problem because now there are two beggars at the same hall. And the suitors encourage them to have a fight, which, of course, Odysseus wins handily. So yeah, you do get a bit of a depiction of it there, that there could even be a bit of sort of professional competition.
More on Hesiod when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Will Brockless, who's filling us in about Hesiod, a contemporary, more or less, of Homer's, and by some accounts a competitor, but he seems to have specialized in more of a working-class audience than did Homer. He did write two great works, his Theogony and then Works and Days in particular, one emphasizing agriculture, and the other, the Theogony, the ways of the gods and the way the gods handled succession, let's say. Did it parallel what was going on historically in Greece at this time in the 7th century BC?
It is possible to see it in that way. A lot of people have looked at the Olympian hierarchy and seen it as something quite similar to Greece a long way back from this time, that we're thinking of about sort of 700 BCE here, going back 500-600 years before that to Mycenaean times, where it was more of a sort of royal culture in palaces. That maybe sort of resembled the Olympians a bit more. You could, though, perhaps tie it to a bit more recent history, that Greece had just gone through a period of considerable strife, where one chieftain would be kicking out one other chieftain, and there would presumably be quite violent succession in that way, until we came down to the stage round about the 8th century BCE, where people were getting settled into city-states with constitutions, with law codes and that sort of thing. You could compare that to what's going on in the Theogony, that to start off with, you've got some really quite violent successions of gods, that, for instance, Kronos castrates his father Uranus.
Don't you just love the kind of Freudian implications behind some of this Greek mythology?
And indeed, that was picked up on by Freud and others. Yeah, there was that, and there's also Zeus who violently overthrows Kronos. But finally, when Zeus comes along, things seem to settle down a bit more, and he allots honours to the different gods in a very just and fair sort of way, and things settled down. So you could maybe parallel that with what was going on, what had been going on in the Greek world, and the more stable state of affairs that they were now in.
And what does Hesiod envision as sort of the origins of it all? You know, what was there before these violent gods?
Well, to start off with, things are a bit less well-defined, that the gods are a bit less personified. And you do have an account, because he goes right back to the start of things, of the very first immortal being. So I might just read a little bit from Martin West's translation here. First came the chasm, and then broad-breasted earth, secure seat forever of all the immortals who occupy the peak of snowy Olympus. The misty Tartarus, that's the underworld, in a remote recess of the broad path to earth, and Eros, the most handsome among the immortal gods, dissolver of flesh, who overcomes the reason and purpose in the breasts of all gods and men. Out of the chasm came Erebos and dark night, and from night in turn came bright air and day, whom she bore in shared intimacy with Erebos. Earth bore first of all one equal to herself, starry heaven, so that he should cover her all about to be a secure seat forever for the blessed gods. And she bore the long mountains, pleasant haunts of the goddesses, the nymphs who dwell in mountain glens, and she bore also the undraining sea in its furious swell, not in union of love. So I think there we have a really interesting answer to a philosophical problem, really. Whenever you give an account of the origins of the world, the creation of the world, one of the questions you've got to answer is, OK, there's a lot of stuff and it's all quite orderly these days in the universe. So where did all that stuff come from? Could that stuff have just appeared out of nothing?
We're still working on it.
And Hesiod kind of goes for a compromise in that he imagines the first being, this chasm, as something apparently very, very insubstantial. In Greek, it kind of means a big gaping hole. But it isn't nothing. It's something. And from that rather insubstantial thing, more substantial things arise, that we get night and Erebos, which is actually the darkness of the underworld, something very specific. And from night you get day. And so things start becoming more and more substantial, and then eventually you get gods in kind of human-type form.
I was trying to listen carefully to your description of Earth.
Yeah.
Is that sort of positive Mother Earth?
Yeah, Earth is kind of a mixed figure in Hesiod, because Earth is a giver of good things. Of course, in the Works and Days, Earth is important as the giver of things to the farmer. He has to work very hard to give these things, but Earth does give good things. Earth is, though, a bit of a mixed character in the Theogony, that first up, she ensures that her husband's demise by giving Kronos a sickle to, as we said, castrate her husband. Later on, she sends up the final challenger to Zeus's rule, this monstrous god Typhoeus, who in fact we get the word typhoon from, that causes these enormous storms. And so, yeah, she's a kind of figure of disorder in that respect, but also a kind of figure of stability, as it says that this earth is going to be a secure seat for everyone and for the Olympians who are going to live up Mount Olympus. So a mixed figure. And also one of the things we've got in the Theogony that Earth is associated with is the politics of male and female gods. That, as I say, yeah, Earth, this female god sends the final challenger to Zeus, and Zeus's order for the universe is represented as a positive thing. So that's not a great thing as Hesiod presents it. But at the same time, Zeus has to himself incorporate the qualities of females in order to rule well, in order to rule better than his father and grandfather had done, who ruled very violently in a very sort of stereotypically masculine, macho sort of way. They just didn't think about what they were doing and just acted violently. And there's an interesting passage that I might just read where it's about Zeus and his first wife. Zeus, as king of the gods, made Metis his first wife, the wisest among gods and mortal men, because Metis kind of means cunning. But when she was about to give birth to the pale-eyed goddess Athene, he tricked her deceitfully with cunning words and put her away in his belly, on the advice of earth and starry heaven. They advised him in this way so that no other of the gods, the eternal fathers, should have the royal station instead of Zeus. For from Metis it was destined that clever children should be born. First a pale-eyed daughter, Tritogenea, that's Athena, with courage and sound counsel equal to her father's. And then a son she was to bear, king of gods and men, one proud of heart. But Zeus put her away in his belly first, so that the goddess could advise him of what was good and bad.
So Zeus ate
his wife, it's
yes,
true. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So it's, yes, that doesn't sound too great. It's an act of violence, it's true.
Doesn't bode too well. Let me just ask this away. What would Zeus's future have been had he not done that? I mean, he could have children, but does he have a future without children? What does he need the children for?
Well, what he needs the children for, I guess, is kind of to be his deputies and carry out his will and all that sort of thing. But all the way through the Theogony, children are represented as a rather dangerous group of people.
Well, they can castrate you.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to watch out for them. This sort of childlessness, though, in the Theogony is not really presented as an option. A lot of the gods are even fantastically fertile and have hundreds and hundreds of offspring. So it kind of seems inevitable that the gods are going to have children. But Zeus, by swallowing the goddess cunning, stops this male offspring being born who it was supposed to be mightier than him and would then chuck him out. He also, through this act of crude violence, frankly, and an act that was rather similar to his own father's act, Kronos, who swallowed his children to prevent them overthrowing him, through that act of violence, he in fact becomes a better god, that he takes on the intelligence that this goddess had. And all the way through through the theogony, the goddesses are very intelligent figures.
Ooh, I'm getting this picture of Zeus behaving in intelligent ways because of swallowing his wife and the female getting no credit.
Yeah, pretty much, I'm afraid. Yeah, at least, I don't know, at least Hesiod gives Metis credit in this little passage. Yeah, I mean, it is ultimately really quite a patriarchal text. But what we can say at least is that when Zeus and his patriarchal regime become dominant right at the end, that it only becomes dominant because Zeus is able to incorporate female qualities into his reign.
And the relationship between Kronos and time.
Those two, they're very, very similar words in Greek, almost identical. And in other traditions, Hesiod doesn't make anything of this, but in other traditions, they were certainly equated with one another. It would be difficult for Hesiod to do that because Hesiod decides to put Kronos in what's by then the third generation of immortals.
Oh, okay.
So you'd want time really to be created right at the beginning.
First, yes.
And in other traditions, yes, it was there right at the beginning, and you want this to be a really sort of primal being. So Hesiod, yeah, really wants to de-emphasise that connection, but it's there for other poets to draw on, and as we've said, there's this competition between the different poets to produce different versions.
Do we have a sense then, where at what point do we see the influence of Hesiod beyond his time?
Beyond his time? Well, he was certainly very big in classical times. He was taking second place to Homer, but there was this tradition that started up in classical times of the competition between the two of them. And there's perhaps a hint of that competition in Hesiod's poetry, where he talks about this competition where he won a prize at funeral games. And so there we have Hesiod being very important. He was also particularly important in Egypt shortly after the time of Alexander the Great, because at that time there were poets who wanted to do everything in a new way, and they also wanted to do everything in a very clever, learned way. And so they looked at guys like Hesiod as somebody who knew an enormous amount of stuff.
This would be, about 300 years after Hesiod's time?
Yeah. We're 300, 400. They were going back to Hesiod as a model and saying, OK, this guy has written these amazingly learned, knowledgeable poems about agriculture. Let's do the same. Let's write poems about types of snake, types of poison and all that sort of thing. And they were using Hesiod as a model for that sort of thing. So at that stage, he became very important as well.
And if you had a 30-second elevator ride with someone and had to tell them who Hesiod was and why he was important and what we'd miss if we didn't ever read him, what would you say?
I think we'd miss half of the Greek world. That we tend to focus on Homer from that time, and we tend to focus on the tales of warriors and noble warriors. These are tales of human beings in peacetime, and they're also tales of poor people trying to make a living. And we'd also miss any sense of where the gods came from. That's what he gives us in so many other poems. We've just got the Olympian gods and we don't have any sense of how they came to that particular situation. Whereas here with Hesiod, you've got a grandiose vision for the whole of the universe, how it came about and where those Olympian gods came from.
Will Brocklus, thanks for lighting up that dark half of the Greek world.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
Thank you.